So tonight is a continuation of the series of the five spiritual faculties. We keep getting interrupted in these series, and we will continue to get interrupted in the weeks ahead, but it matters not. We'll bind them all together as we go here. And the faculties that we have spoken about and have been faith and effort, and tonight we're going to talk about mindfulness. And there are two others. There's samadhi, or concentration, and wisdom. So we're in the middle of the series right now, and these faculties are what we need in the Buddhist tradition to really bring forth the fruition of practice. So they're not small, insignificant components of the practice. They're really the mainstay that drive the whole of the practice. And tonight we're going to look at mindfulness, but I want to put a little different slant to mindfulness. I'm going to do it in relationship to faith, so that we always hold faith as sort of the fundamental impetus behind the entire movement of practice, which is a little disconcerting to some of us. Perhaps we feel that we need to be more in control than faith allows. And for much of our practice, we feel that we are self-driven. Our practice is very much self-determined. But as wisdom component comes forward, we'll begin to see that what we thought was the ruling class of the Dharma is actually the recipients of faith moment after moment, and how the practice evolves into that understanding is very much the movement from faith to wisdom. And so this meditation is all about that movement, really, that terrain that we cross from being very self-controlling and self-centered and self-influenced, where we are operating the levers of our own growth, to just being wide open and at awe, really. It's a sense of awe that we come into, and we realize that everything that we thought we have done has really been counterproductive. But we have to go a long way to get there. So we want to start the traveling a little bit tonight. And again, I want to emphasize this because it's a very important aspect of the practice, is that when I move us through the different aspects of mindfulness, as I did through faith, as I did through effort, it's very important to see that we are all of the above. At any one time, our understanding shifts and we find ourselves in bright faith, or what I will call bright mindfulness, or verified mindfulness, or abiding mindfulness. And each of those terms are connected to the expression and evolution of faith, and no one term describes our practice more than a moment. So don't think, oh my God, I've got so long to go in this. All you have to do, all we ever have to do, so let's just put it out there, all right? All we ever have to do is cross an idea. That's the traveling. That's the journey. We make an assumption, an idea about ourselves, and the whole of the spiritual journey is to release ourselves from that assumption. Now, how hard can that be? And we just dig these enormous holes rather than just... So faith, you might say, the difference between blind faith and abiding faith is the release from an idea. So we can do that. We can do that. You can say, well, that's 20,000 lifetimes from now. Well, okay, if you want to journey with a backpack for that long, or we can just do it now. And I will always encourage and strengthen the conviction that it is now. It is available now. It is available now. Not after 20 years of practice. Not after I get through with the homework. But now. So this is the message of immediacy and the message of hope at the same time. Now, faith focuses energy. It focuses energy into effort. But effort towards what? Effort towards what? So, faith, if we don't have a rationale of where we're going, is really kind of empty-handed. We need some sense of direction for ourselves, some way to conceptualize the journey so that we can feel as if we are partaking in it. And it's real important. I mean, that's really what the Buddhist tradition is. It's what the Christian tradition is. It gives you a framework in which to operate your faith and to drive your effort towards resolution. Because without that, we're a little bit like someone who has a weapon that could shoot himself or the person next to him if he didn't know how to operate the weapon as easily as he could in the rightful way of using it. So we have to understand the methods that we employ. We have to understand the logic and rationale of why we are involved in this in order for the faith to have some sense of direction for itself, and in order for that faith then to hook into effort and for that effort to be employed towards our benefit, not towards our lacking or against us. And the key to having effort work in line, in alignment with the conceptual journey is that we have to be interested in where we're going and what we're doing. I can't overestimate the importance of interest. Without interest, our commitment is fractured. It's like, oh, should I do the practice today? Well, I'd rather just kind of... And what is so seductive and seems so close at hand is the temptations of pleasure, of being soothed. We're on our breath, and then we're lost in thought. And the thought, because we can conceive of anything we want, can be extraordinarily pleasant. You can think of anything. Just think of something that you enjoyed doing 2 years ago and bring it to mind. There it is. Again, the pleasant feeling is associated with that thought through conditioning. So why go back to my breath? I'm not really interested in my breath. I'm interested in the pursuit of this, the path of pleasure. So the rationale or the conceptualization of the path shakes us from that pleasant abiding and says, look, pleasant isn't good enough. We don't know that for a fact, but some sensor in our minds says, the judger says, you're not really doing the meditation. And then begrudgingly we'll release ourselves from the thought and try to accommodate the breath. It's the fact that we're not really interested in our life. We're not really interested in our life. Let us just admit it. We're interested in what our life will become. We put a lot of energy in that. We're interested in what our life will produce, but notice the future tense. But our life is living now. And few of us are really interested in what our life is doing now, is living now, is the immediacy of our life. So we're very interested in where we're going to go, but where we're going to go is just more thinking. And so thinking holds its own goals, its own fascination, its own interest. And when I do come to the present moment, what do I find here? But a lot of unsatisfactoriness, really. It's hot in this room. Sun's in my eyes. And somehow we have to re-own our life. We have to gain some interest in it. Now, that's paradoxical. Because what it does is it takes attention with an A, it takes an intention with an I to establish attention with an A, so that we will focus on something. And when we do focus on something, the very focus of paying attention to it brings interest. And we have, in the course of our life, placed obstacles to paying attention to anything. And so, of course, we're not interested because we've never really paid attention. And so we have to go through the obstacles that we've placed in the way of our attention to bring forth the aliveness of our interest. Interest is the key. Emily Dickinson said, "To live is so startling. There is little time for anything else." So we need a tool that will allow us close observation. And in Buddhism, that tool is mindfulness. That tool is the observing power of the mind. The observing power of the mind. Now, most of us perhaps do not know, but when we observe something, there is a moment of pure awareness before the mind fractures what we see into two, me and the thing I'm observing. There is a moment of pure awareness. And that moment of pure awareness does not have a dualistic split within it. And what mindfulness attempts to do is to prolong that sense of observation, that sense of pristine connectedness, before the mind takes off and starts running with its ideas about what it sees, or judges what it sees, or remembers seeing something like that before. All of which creates a sense of someone seeing something. But mindfulness, in the moment of the immediate moment of observation, awareness does not have that split. And what we're attempting to do in using mindfulness is to prolong that sense of connectiveness within the immediacy of observation. So what do we tell you not to do? Don't judge. Don't condemn. Don't think about it. Right? All the ways that you prolong the experience into two, you extract the two from the one, mindfulness is an attempt to go back the other way, to throw the two back together into the one. But we're not very successful at that, if we're honest. In fact, we are much more successful in thinking about what we notice than being really clear and upfront with our bare attention of just the fact of what we see. Even though all of the instructions move us towards that bare attention of just seeing, just observing, just the breath. Now, why is that so? It's because all the filters we have placed between ourselves and the immediate moment, boredom, lethargy, wanting to be soothed, wanting pleasant things, not wanting the unpleasant, fearing what this may hold in terms of what it means about me. All of those things are what we have to come through to get ourselves back in to the rightful relationship in the present moment. Because we don't want to touch those things, we'd rather stay too. Staying too, I can just keep throwing them out of my mind onto you. This situation's boring. It's too hot in here. Whining. That's what we have to come back into. So in order to find the interest that will allow us to recouple up for the two train cars to recouple. So mindfulness, when we first start, so I don't want to take us too far out. I want us just to, right where we start. Okay, so mindfulness, in its beginning, when we first sit down, in some ways, when we first sit down, the first time you've ever sat down in meditation, you were as close to the truth as you've ever been. Because you didn't know what this was about. You hadn't done it before. You had no expectations of what was going to come out of it. You sat down. Perhaps you had this quizzical quality within you, like, what's this? What's all this about? What's this about? Let me just see what is this? And in the moment that we genuinely offered that innocence to the present moment, there was the ever-ready potential and possibility that the two would come back to one. And since then, many of us now who have navigated many hours of meditation and have heard whatever the mind has to say over and over again and have traveled the terrain of our emotions and now knows the landscape of meditation so well that when we sit down, oh, I know what this, yeah, I've done this before, okay. And so nothing new really gets into us much anymore. Oh, I had a typical meditation. I was just on the breath once every 10 minutes. But we get used to that kind of defeatism. But mindfulness in bright faith, when we just have an inspiration, we're inspired by something, when we think that this potential could actually pay off. Mindfulness from that place can be very inspiring and interesting if we focus our attention in the right way, with the right degree of effort. And the effort in the beginning, the effort in bright faith, is really kind of, can become a very drudgery kind of effort. It's like letting go of the thoughts and coming back to the breath, and it's all about me and what kind of difficult time I'm having. And very soon after the practice begins, it just feels like trial and tribulation, doesn't it? Like the hardest work we've ever done. And the mindfulness gets bogged down, and it just feels like a burden. It's like something else I have to do. Now, I have to mow the lawn, do the dishes, and be mindful. And it can become very mechanical in that sense. It can become very mechanistic. Where, you know, it doesn't feel exactly what you've always done. And it feels like, you know, okay, be mindful. Wash the dishes and be mindful. Oh. And then we just keep losing our way, and it brings up a lot of sense of failure, and this is another thing we can't do. And it just kind of gets, it's like walking through molasses. So we need a point of entry in order to bring forth some interest in these early days of practice, in this, as bright faith begins to get dull with the work that is necessary, not just the aha experience that felt so uplifting, but now the heavy-handed work that's necessary. And when we deal with this mind that seems so laborious and heavy all the time, we need a point of entry. We need some way for our focus, our effort to be energetically aroused through interest. And what I would like to suggest is that point of entry is our body. Our body. It's magical. And it gives you all the messages of the Dharma within it. I was watching a PBS series last night. It was a group of biologists, and they were stating that that they no longer ascribe to Darwinian theory of evolution, of natural selection, but rather they believe that anyone who really looks at a cell, the cell of a body, in the body, looks at the cell and what it's contained within it, and all of the different creative expressions that go on in a cell, cannot but come to the conclusion that there is an intelligence that drives the creation. And these were renowned biologists. Now, when I heard that, I kind of flinched. Part of me flinched because that can be the Christian right that's coming at me there. That's the flinch. Or it can be genuine fascination with the body, with seeing that the body holds a vast intelligence, which is unmistakable for anyone who's ever delved into it. If we can bring the energy into the body, into the body's energy, and really connect with the sense of bodiness, groundedness, it's like every cell in the body comes alive within that awareness. And it's fascinating because you feel aging. Not as something that's happening to you, but something that is you. And you feel all of the symptoms of whatever illness you might have, as well as the expressions of health. I'm going to the gym two or three times a week, and I'm lifting weights. And I just can't believe how the body has come alive. Because within that weightlifting environment, I'm also getting deeper and deeper embedded within the body and just noticing the change in the expression. Doesn't counteract age, but it's done a lot for arthritis that I have, for lots of limitations that have up until this time I thought have been one way. And it's just fascinating to me. And it's a point of entry into the very real interest we need to make this practice work for us. Mindfulness of the body. And it acts as a lightning rod for reactivity. Some of you have heard this story before, but I'll share it again. I was out on a retreat at Cloud Mountain. Cloud Mountain has this little Buddha statue, and people give little offerings to this Buddha statue. It's outdoors between the dining hall and the meditation hall, and you pass it as you go from one to the other. And so they give maybe like coins, or they'll give rocks, or they'll give a leaf or something. And anyway, there's all this stuff around this Buddha. And in this particular retreat, they weren't offering desserts. and someone had left a big chocolate by the Buddha. And I happened to be a chocolate fan. So I was walking and just noticing the array of ornaments around the Buddha, and I noticed this chocolate. And I thought, that Buddha doesn't need that chocolate. And the words no sooner came out of my mouth than it was like a lightning rod. You know, where the thought came and immediately it was grounded. Part of me was paranoid that someone might see me take it, I'm sure. But part of it was just the, you know, just seeing that as a reaction, just seeing that as an impulse, just the impulse. And the body holding the impulse, you could feel it. You could feel the impulse coming in and moving right down and out of the body into the earth, like a lightning rod. It's a very appropriate analogy. But if we don't have that grounding, if we don't have that ground, that point of entry for our mindfulness, then life can get very airy. If you stay out somewhere, you know, reflecting all the time or looking at just the ephemeral quality of emotions without being embodied within that, then you're going to find yourself kind of adrift, afloat. But the body holds a stability of observation that also allows for discovery and interest. So if you find your practice to be kind of uninteresting, go into this thing. You can hold your attention on a single cell in your forefinger. Or you can hold your attention over the entire surface of your body at the same time. Now, what is that? The aliveness you feel. Just feel your right hand as we speak. Feel it come alive. Feel the palm. Isn't that interesting? To bring yourself alive by inviting your awareness within your body. We begin then making the unconscious known. Because if we don't have a ground or a point of entry, the unconscious just moves us. The Buddha said, wherever there is grasping, Mara will track you down. Mara is the personification of ignorance, of suffering, disappointment. Wherever there is grasping, Mara will track you down. You see, there is grasping at the chocolate. Gotcha, Rodney. No. You're an impulse, and out you go. And in that freshness, where the mindfulness is stabilized and walking the earth, everything is seen from the view of beauty, from the stance of connection. Like the poem I wrote, I read. So mindfulness with bright faith needs an entry point. Once it has that entry point and has that interest, then it can slowly begin to develop psychic, what I call psychic receptivity. That is, we are no longer leaning into our experience, but we're inviting a different kind of response to our life, where we're receiving life. It's as if we're a radio antenna and all the waves are coming into the antenna. We are just receiving life, receiving it, receiving the transmissions that are out there. That helps encourage faith. Because when we're in a receptive mode rather than a doing mode, what we began to see is, like the Zen poem, sitting alone, doing nothing, spring comes and the grass grows by itself. Sitting alone, doing nothing, everything happens on its own. And we actually begin to see that occurring. That encourages deeper and richer and more faith. But we have to see that occurring for us to know the limitations of our own need to control. We have to see that life doesn't require our control for it to move and continue. Some of us feel like if I gave up my worry, it wouldn't turn out all right. In order for something to turn out all right, it needs me to worry about it. You feel that? That's sick. You got to test that theory. Because the spirit of meditation is in relaxation, not in tension. The tension is the all-powerful sense of me. It's really a betrayal of your own humility. You think everything is governed, you know, back in the Galileo days, they thought everything revolved around the earth. Well, we're even more primitive than that. We think everything revolves around me. You have to test that. Observing rather than doing. Observing rather than doing. And we get to the point we're still on bright mindfulness. So I've got to speed up a little. We began to get a sense that mindfulness, observation, can be trusted, as I've mentioned before. That it's not going to betray me, because in fact I can see whatever it is that I put between myself and what is occurring, and that's the betrayal, never the fact. It's what I bring to the fact that betrays the fact. The fact never betrays me. And over time, we actually get a sense of how observation of the bare fact, without me constantly judging and opinionating about it, is a safe relationship to the world. So there's a huge step over mistrust. Many of us have deep feelings of mistrust because we don't trust the fact. Facts have betrayed us. No, we have betrayed the fact. The fact is just what is. The fact is just the reality of the situation. It's never pro or against. It's never one-sided. It's not personal. No fact is personal. Death is not personal. But we certainly make it so. But in our observation, we begin to see, our mindfulness, we begin to see that. So you see, this is, now we're going, moving through into wisdom, but so bright faith begins to show us the nature of life as it is. However, at this stage, there's still a big sense of me. Now, all of us have times in our practice where we're very present and we believe very strongly in the meditator who's meditating. And we're struggling with him or her, and mostly we just think it's me sitting again. For us to move into this next form of mindfulness, called verified mindfulness, from verified faith, we have to begin to hold the perception that meditation is not about me becoming more comfortable and happier in my life. It is about something much deeper and richer than that. It is about coming back from two to one, coming back to the interconnectedness of things. We're never going to move from that step to this one if it's only going to be about you and self-serving you, because meditation will augment, complement, supplement you, because you're not using the tool in its correct alignment. So to come into verified mindfulness, we have to be willing to connect with a deeper sense of reactivity within us, these deeper passions within us, these deeper reserved emotional tendencies we have, beginning to look at those things, feel them. Not to own them as I, me, or mine, that's just going backward. But just to see them, let them come, let them move through us. Let them be verified as what they really are in my observation. Let them be no more than what they are, which is just this. They're only that much. They're only this much. So now in verified mindfulness, the mind begins to see how it struggles at everything. And it begins to ask the deeply impersonal question, as opposed to bright mindfulness, or where we were just asking, every question was personal. How can I get out of this pain and this hurts, and how can I get over this, and how can I make my practice better, and all of those are very personal. Now we're moving into the impersonal questions of just seeing, just observation. There's a strong sense of watcher, of watching, strong sense of observation, but the observation begins to show us, because now it's a benign and benevolent observation. It's a kind observation, so we're not berating ourselves anymore, so that it becomes less personal of a process. Every emotion that comes up isn't all about me and how troubled I am and what my father did to me. It becomes the expression of nature, like the armadillo or the serpent that I read in the poem. And now the faith becomes verified because it's not putting anything between itself and the fact of what it sees. It's just seeing what is arising without personalizing or creating any kind of self-description over, beyond the fact of what's arising. Even though there still seems to be, and this is an intermediate point of practice, this isn't the end, this is just a phase of practice, that sense of watcher is very much there. And all of us who have practiced a little while, perhaps not people from the beginning class, but you will if you continue, will have moments in which things are just coming, and there's just this ease of watching. And nothing is personal, nothing is taken as dramatically mine. Just stuff coming. Even if we've lost for 10 minutes, oh, it's just stuff. And there's genuine ease with that, genuine relaxation with that. Okay, it's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. I was off for 10 minutes, okay. And that has come from entering the point of entry, embodying the point of entry, taking up that sense of receptivity, beginning to see how life is revealed through receptive posture rather than assertive posture. And as we bring all of those qualities as well as kindness, we cut the long established conditioned response of reactivity and personalization, and then faith becomes verified. Oh, I know now what he's talking about. Seeing things as they are. It's no big deal. But then we have another step. Not into fairyland. Not into New Age romanticism. But into the truth. And that's abiding mindfulness from abiding faith. At this stage, the eye is known for what it is. It's known and understood. It no more catches you up than a car that passes you in the street. An effort at this phase is releasing the sense of I, just releasing it. When it comes, oh, I don't need that anymore. I don't need to do that anymore. And when you feel that sense of egoic madness arise, I don't need to do that anymore. I don't need to posture myself around everywhere. I don't have to do that anymore. You just release it because it's burdensome. It hurts. It's tiring. And we have verified the pain of the struggle. And the verification of the pain of the struggle ends in the release of that struggle. Four Noble Truths. And at this time, we just, okay. So we go through the eye, not around it or shunt it, or obliterate it, or stomp it out. We go through it. We go through it. But what is it? It's just walking through a fog. We walk through a fog. We walk through a mist in this city many times a year. This is another mist. The mist of me. Awareness now. Awareness becomes the point. Presence becomes the point of focus. Present. The point where we are focused now is not on a sense of me, but on awareness itself. Awareness becomes our point of reference. Awareness is what we relax into. And when we relax into presence, the eye dissipates. And now we're abiding in awareness. No longer is it fabricated mindfulness that I'm doing as a burden, as something I have to do from the point of sense of self. But now it's abiding awareness, abiding in it, with it, of it. You can't shake it. We can't shake this thing. It's not as if it even needs to be manufactured. When I was with Ajahn Buddhadasa, he would just sit there all day long, chickens and dogs barking, people coming up. He'd just sit there, handling whatever came up. He would just, all day long. And I would be sitting up there watching him just, I would think, God, that's anatta. The man had no, it was Christ standing on the mound with his arms open saying, everybody come. No limits. And when you talk to him, wasn't doing anything special, which always teed me off. Because I was working hard. And he was abiding. And I was forcing. So let us abide for a moment or two.